Terror on the High Seas, the new book from Daniel Sekulich. We'll get to some of those terror parts, too, coming up in just a second. And also about how it's possible that we might be able to stop piracy in the oceans if we only took a lesson from our pages in history of how they have, if not stopped it, curtailed it before. But we'd have to have a strong stomach for this next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Bonnet. Terror on the Seas, Daniel Sekulich is the author. So Daniel, I mean, we look at, you mentioned Captain Kidd earlier, and he was hanged after they caught him. And he wasn't even that good of a pirate. They caught him, hanged him in London down by the hanging dock. And then the plan would be to wrap his body in tar or something and then leave him up there for years.
Yeah, there was a certain macabre sense of how they tried to deter pirates and criminals back then. And the process was kind of interesting because what they would do is take a condemned man from, in his case, you know, whether it's Newgate Prison or Highgate, and they would take them to the execution dock, hang them, allow the body to be washed over by the tide, and then the body was tarred and hung in a gibbet further down the Thames where passing ships could see it so that, you know, crows could peck at it and whatnot.
Sure. But it would be a way that other ships would be passing by it and they would say, who's that? And they would say, oh, that's Captain Kidd the pirate. And it would keep reinforcing the idea that this could end up being you.
Yeah, you know, it was a very crude form of deterrence.
Right.
But it's a sign of what you have to do is show criminals very, very, you know, openly that you will take action against them. And you will prosecute, you will capture them, and you will prosecute them to the full extent of the law.
Well, and so we've talked about how these pirates are already thumbing their nose at the law. They don't, you know, they don't care. And they're in some cases, they're within the 12-mile zone of their own country, so that technically what they're doing may be robbery, but it's not piracy.
Yeah. But even if they're outside in international waters, we've seen this happening in the last few months. We're constrained by legal requirements. We're the good guys, right? We have to follow the rules. So we've had cases where naval warships, most recently we had a Canadian one, encountered a bunch of pirates who were acting suspiciously. They had ladders aboard their skiffs, and they had automatic weapons and other weaponry on it.
They're not fishing.
They're not fit. Well, if they are, they're doing overkill, let me tell you.
Right.
But so what all of the naval crew could do was dispose of the weapons and let the guys go because they weren't caught in the act.
Okay. So here's a question for you. As you research piracy in the book Terror on the Seas, you talk about privateers. You talk about the pirates that had a letter of marque. Explain that.
A letter of marque was a form of state-sanctioned piracy. And what that was is at times in years, centuries gone by, when nations couldn't afford to keep a full navy going, what they would do would rely on private citizens to be given permission by their government to arm their vessel and attack their enemies. So England would issue a letter of marque to a consortium of businessmen who would get a ship together, hire a crew, put some cannons aboard it, and set off to attack, for instance, their Spanish enemies. Although they weren't technically at war, it was a form of a Cold War going on.
Right.
And the crew that captured an enemy vessel had to return a portion of whatever plunder they got into the Admiralty's coffers, for instance. You had people like Francis Drake was perhaps the most famous and most successful privateer of all, and he made millions of dollars for Queen Elizabeth I, good Queen Bess,
right,
and helped to enrich England at a time when its economy wasn't doing so well.
Right, when $1 million really meant something.
When $1 million really meant something, absolutely.
Right. All right, so here's my thought. Why wouldn't it work that the U.S. government would start handing out letters of marque? What if before you throw the idea out, what if in order to fight piracy, we commissioned, maybe it's the same sort of thing, a consortium of businesses willing to put up the money up front, but we said, look, here's who you can steal from, and you can take whatever they have, and we'll use that as a deterrent. And we see the greater good here is, A, it'll give people who are unemployed in this country a way to make a living, although what a horrible way to make a living, but at least it'll... And we could say, we are not going to prosecute you as long as you don't go after ships from the following countries of registry, but you can go after any pirate ship that you find anywhere. And so they go to South China Seas, they go into Somalia, they go to these places. They're taking a risk, no doubt, and they're being mercenaries. But wouldn't it be interesting to see what would happen to piracy in these countries if they actually had competition from a country that was not constrained by the same rules of engagement that our Navy and our merchant marines are constrained now? What do you think?
It's an absolutely interesting concept, and I can tell you that people have talked about it within parts of the shipping community.
Cool.
Unfortunately, letters of marque are no longer legal. It was decided in the 19th century that one of the problems with that is that a lot of privateers who originally got letters of marque, such as Captain Kidd, then turned to piracy when they decided they could make more money. It opened up a Pandora's box, and it was really hard to put those pirates back into that box thereafter.
But I understand that.
But you are seeing modern-day privateers in the sense of private security firms.
All right, good. So,
they operate ships in the Gulf of Aden that can be hired to provide escort services and to deal with pirates.
Yeah, but see, that's kind of the equivalent of the big burly guy with a cell phone standing behind Zsa Zsa Gabor. You know, I mean, it doesn't really have the romance of somebody out there who's really going after what the pirates have, because you might find that, I appreciate this idea about the letter of marque is very complicated. And yes, Captain Kidd started off as, a wealthy person in New York, got bored, became a privateer, got bored apparently, and decided to start becoming a pirate, did no longer like to follow the rules, anybody's rules, and so ended up becoming a pirate. But then he was executed, which goes back to how we started the hour. I mean, I still think we could say that to our new privateers. Look, you mess with us, you come after who you shouldn't come after, and you're on your own. But up until that point, we won't prosecute you for the crimes you do if in the end we're using privateering to stop piracy.
Yeah, it's as I said, it's a great concept. It's just no nation, I think, right now wants to delve into that for fear of what it could lead to down the line. I think history has shown us that it becomes a slippery slope once we get into what amounts to a form of state-sanctioned sort of a covert warfare.
Yeah, it's definitely like Halliburton run amok. It might even be
an episode of 24.
It is. I'm ready. I mean, I think it's, I mean, we look at, and I think that there's a way, and as you said before, pirates don't really respond to anything else. They're not, if you passed a new law saying they're illegal, they would laugh at that like they laughed at the other 24 laws they're already breaking.
They're absolutely, and they're already illegal under national laws, and they're considered enemies of all mankind under international laws.
Yeesh.
We haven't exactly had, there's not much more we can do legally
with
lawyers and judges.
Thank you.
Unless you actually prosecute, capture them and take them home. There's a whole question about this idea about prosecuting them, and they may end up claiming asylum or they're getting a free run. I don't buy that.
Okay.
I think you get them into a, if you capture them, put them in jail, prosecute them, sentence them, you send them home. You don't allow them to have asylum or claim some sort of refugee status or anything like that. If they know they're not going to get a free ride, and that's really what it comes down to, right?
Right.
Don't make it easy for them. Then that becomes another deterrent, because then they realize that, oops, there are complications that could come with this going out in this boat today.
Right. All right. So you've talked to some of these pirates, right? You've
Yep.
interviewed pirates.
Yep.
How did you find them?
Motley. Most of them, the ones that I met, and I'm especially thinking of an Indonesian pirate,
Okay.
just did not, it's a life of crime does not hold so many of the potentials that you think it is when you get into it. And the reality is, you're probably not going to be doing it for a long time. It's not a good professional career choice. And it's fraught with so many risks that these guys, it ends up eating away at them in a really, really big way. And in many cases, they end up dying on the job, or if they try and get out of a gang, something can go wrong.
Right.
People don't like it when someone leaves a gang. Are they going to talk? Are they going to reveal information to the police?
Right.
These guys tend to be poor to begin with and desperate. And, they end up, they're at the end of the draw of their life, and they figure, well, I got nothing else to lose. I may as well try this.
Right. A lot of them are sending, although they may be sending money home, a lot of them probably have to avoid the law in their own country, just like they're avoiding the law out on the seas. But where is it that where I mean, as you talk to these folks and you got a sense of who they were, I know they don't have the romantic notions perhaps of piracy that we have here because of the pirates of our Caribbean and all. But I mean, do they regret what they're doing while they're doing it, or only sometime later on? I mean, do they feel bad, but they don't have a choice, or do they just don't care? And they just, they're there to take your money. If you have to die, that's fine. They'll push you overboard just as soon as look at you.
Well, the responses have been both, and that is, I've met and talked to people other people who've met pirates who have, there's been a great degree of guilt. They knew they were doing something wrong when they began, but
Okay.
they had to subsume that beneath the goal, which is, okay, here's the mission. We got to go out. We have to attack a ship. We may have to inflict violence on the crew in order to get the job done. And they just try to forget about it. Maybe they try it by drinking when they're off, drinking heavily when they get back to
Right.
shore, or using drugs. There are other ones who, these are the ones who tend to move up the ladder quickly, who seem to don't care one bit. Their moral center is gone. They don't care about what they're doing. They're focused. They just look on other mariners and as targets. And these are the dangerous criminals, because these are the ones who end up becoming, as I said, they move up a gang, they become the
Sure.
leaders. And
Sure.
those are the ones that you should be most afraid of.
What's the other than the keeping people indefinitely, in the brig or whatever, as you said, that is its own kind of hell. What are some of the other things that these pirates have been doing that establish their ruthless reputation?
Well, one of the first things they do is remove the ability for a crew on a ship to communicate with anyone else, and they control that. And you have to remember, when you're on a ship, I mean, when you're at sea, it's a pretty lonely place. So your only means of communication are radio and satellite phones. And that allows you to have some sort of connection with society. And when you remove that, it's like placing someone in solitary confinement. The other thing that they will do when they come aboard a ship is make sure that they split up the crew so that you don't want to have the whole crew all clustered together in one place for fear that they will try to mount some sort of, counterattack. So suddenly you're on a ship with your crewmates, but you can't associate with your other crewmates. So that removes another layer of that ability to have a social interaction. And then, of course, you can get into the simple things. They start to limit the amount of food because they have to ration things out. If you're on a ship stuck off of Somalia, chances are the air conditioning isn't going to be turned on, so you're going to be
Right.
sweating it out. It's sheer boredom. There's nothing to do. And then, if you should be stupid enough, I might say, to try something, you're apt to get a rifle butt in the side of the head as well.
But that all sounds much more doable than I would have thought these pirates would have been, known for being. I mean, especially when you're talking about the pirates of West Africa and being more ruthless. I mean, it sounds like they're really kind of going out of their way to not kill people and to, you know, they don't want to hurt you unless you make them, or, you know, it doesn't sound to me quite as bad as I would have thought.
Perhaps it isn't, but I mean, I still wouldn't want to be held hostage for two, three, four, five, six, 7 months.
Right.
By a bunch of pirates aboard a ship with no end in sight.
Right.
And there you get into what mariners I've talked to have been held hostage, called the mental torture that goes on. And, you know, the one person, I didn't put it in the book, but one guy was talking to me about, he was an American, and he said, you know, he now knows exactly what his dad went through when he was captured during the Vietnam War.
Right.
And this sense of being held against your will, being tortured mentally, and broken down. And that's, so yeah, okay, on one hand, it doesn't sound so bad. Okay, if you can sit it out for a few months, the ship owner will pay off the money, and then you can go home.
Right.
But that's an, you know, come on, for anybody, that's an awful bad way of doing business.
No. I understand that. There's so many different ways here I want to go with this. So the pirates that are out there, we've talked about this, they're capturing hundreds of ships, they're ransoming. Is there no end in sight to piracy as you see it? I mean, short of my theory about, you know, writing letters of marque and sending privateers back out to disrupt piracy in these other countries, what's the future? How's it going to change?
Well, I don't think piracy will ever change. It actually fundamentally hasn't. It's reappeared under different guises. It's become perhaps a little more sophisticated in terms of the use of technology today. But it will, anywhere that we forget to look at, and anywhere where a security threat props up, where a country is, you know, maybe without ruling government or law and order, you know, and it's on the coastline and people get desperate, it will happen again. You know, you alluded earlier to, it takes a strong stomach to deal with piracy. And, you know, this is true, and this is something that Americans forget, but when you go back to the Barbary Wars back in the early part of the 19th century, around 1801, that was at a time when North African pirates were attacking American ships, and they were at one point getting a ransom of $1 million a year from Washington in order to not attack the ships, and yet they continued doing it. And that took, finally, the first time that the U.S. actually made post-independence, a military incursion against foreigners, was when they finally had enough and sent the U.S. Navy over to battle the Barbary pirates. And that's where we get the first line of the U.S. Marine Corps hymn, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli.
Right.
And that took a considerable amount of political action to finally say, okay, we're going to send our new Navy over there to attack these guys.
And that's kind of what we sort of need to do again then.
We need to, yeah, there's a need for something more than just having patrol ships wander around in the middle of the western part of the Indian Ocean, hoping to deter an attack. I mean, the only way you fundamentally deal with piracy is to attack the root causes and the root bases ashore. Piracy doesn't begin at sea. It begins on land. And in Somalia is just rife with various militia gangs and warlords who are making a lot of money off of this and need to be deterred.
Right. Now, there's some other options there, and I'm sure that'll come up when we get rolling here. I want to pick up a conversation we had earlier about the soul of a ship. I want to ask whether you ever came across anybody that had a ship that was attacked by pirates and whether or not the soul of the ship had been changed. I know they changed the names, which is an interesting thing that the pirates are doing, that they take a ship, they change its name, and then they use this new ship to go attack other ships. Also coming up, we'll talk to Daniel Sekulich about the life of these countries where piracy is rolling high, and whether there's anything we can do about that. What we can do to stop terror on the seas by, as he says, addressing the problems on the land. And where's Al-Qaeda in this? If this is terror on the seas, where's Al-Qaeda? Are they behind this too in some places? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. We're talking with Daniel Sekulich about his book, Terror on the High Seas. So we hear the word terror. Where is Al-Qaeda in this? Are any of these the part of the same Al-Qaeda operations we were hearing about last week? Amoral, a religious, just mafia-like organizations that are all about making money. They may recruit on the basis of the greater good that you're doing for Allah or whatever. But it really just comes down to is it's just about making money, even if it means completely contradicting all of the religious principles for which you supposedly stand. We'll find out about Al-Qaeda in Terror on the Sea next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So where is Al-Qaeda in this terror operation in these international piracy cartels, Daniel?
Well, we now believe that they may be on the ground in Somalia itself. There have been reports that have been trickling in the last few months, and the U.S. Intelligence sources recently informed the Security Council of the U.N. that they believe that there were as many as 300 foreign fighters who have filtered into Somalia. The reason for this is there is an Islamist group in the southern part of the country called Al-Shabaab, who have been fighting to gain control of the country and to impose their own extreme form of Islamic law on the country. They have made some very overt overtures to Al-Qaeda, hoping to form some sort of partnership. And as a result of this, Al-Qaeda seems to have been willing to dispatch some of its fighters from Afghanistan and Pakistan into Somalia. And I was speaking to a colleague of mine just a few days ago who reported to me that in one coastal community, the leader of the local Al-Shabaab unit wasn't even a Somali. He was actually a Chechen.
That's interesting. So we were talking about this last week because there's a book out by Gretchen Peters about how Al-Qaeda really is, by and large, I mean, it's really just another mafia-like organization. They just happen to have, in some parts of it, kind of the polish of a religious organization, but they really aren't. They don't live it. They just, it's all about making money. She says she's not quite willing to say that they don't believe anything that they say. There's still 10% of them in there that are fanatics. But in the meantime, it just, they see dollar signs and they think, oh, it's a way to disrupt the West and also get rich, you know, trying. And they consider that to be sort of tantamount to doing God's work.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've seen, you know, the Taliban has been more than willing lately to take a cut from the poppy farmers in Afghanistan in order to fund their insurgency in Afghanistan. And the same thing has been happening in southern Somalia, that Islamist groups like Al-Shabaab have been more than willing to take a cut of the financing, which comes from the pirates operating in the territory they control, in order to continue to fund their ongoing battles against the other government there. And yeah, this is supposedly, they say, well, once we take over, we're going to eradicate piracy because it is against our beliefs. But right now, well, the devil is in the bargain type of thing.
Right. So what's the most awful thing? I mean, as you were doing your research on this, and we've talked about, you know, the putting people in these sort of perpetual states where they never know whether they're going back home again. But I mean, as piracy is getting amped up and there's more and more of these groups that are out there, what do you think of when you see these groups as they're competing for the dollars and they're going to be more and more of them out there? What do you think it's going to end up being like? I mean, what do you think piracy is going to end up looking like, say, 3 or 4 years from now?
Well, it's a hard question to answer in the sense that I suspect that if we are able to finally contain piracy in Somalia, we're going to find it cropping up somewhere else. It's just, it's historically done that. It's always been like that. You put out a brush fire in one place and it pops up somewhere else. You know, there's these instances where we tend to forget a place. Somalia is a really good example. And in turning our backs on it, it just, crime goes rampant on shore and at sea.
Right.
You know, you talk about some of the, you know, you ask, you know, what are some of the worst things that can happen? And, you know, there's been a lot of news lately about the demise or supposed demise of the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. Well, I remember a case where the Tigers set out and attacked a Chinese fishing boat a few years ago. And this may be one of the most egregious examples of what can happen to defenseless mariners. And it was in the middle of the night, and these guys were fishing in international waters when a bunch of boats swarmed around them like sharks. And what they did was the guy started shooting up the fishing trawler. Well, okay, so that's pretty bad. So the guys on the Chinese fishermen, they jump into the sea to try and escape their ship as it's sinking. And what did these tigers then do? Well, then they started shooting the survivors. And I can't think of anything worse than that, being defenseless, caught at night, far from home,
right.
being predated upon someone like that.
Oh, that's just awful. So, but again, it speaks to the idea that if these guys are desperate and they don't see a future for themselves, and they're going to be, there's more and more of these crews that are going off in the water, and they are technologically savvy, and they, you know, they realize this is a high-stakes game out in the middle of the ocean. It's either going to be, you know, them or the opponents. I wonder what it's going to be like. I wonder whether, as you say, these sort of milder pirates off the coast of Somalia, I wonder what's going to happen with them, or for that matter, anywhere else around the world. I fear for the future safety of mariners if these companies don't, you know, ramp up their game and start giving them extra protection and ways to fight off pirates.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more, Ian. I think that we've looked on piracy recently in a completely wrong manner, and that is we've thought of it as some sort of thing that affects people in the far-off part of the world, mariners from a third-world country. And what happened with the Maersk Alabama, for instance, really did bring it home, that it affects all of us. And I think we have to think about this as that we are involved in a war against an enemy. And, you know, I categorize piracy as the world's longest-running, low-level armed conflict, which has been it's carried out against the community with its own history, its own traditions, its own language, its own sense of community. Those are mariners, whether they're on a pleasure boat or they're professional mariners. And unless you think of it as a war, I don't think you can provide the proper resources politically or militarily to deal with it.
Right, right. No, I totally agree. Well, that'll be interesting to see what happens now. At the very beginning of the show, we were talking about the soul of a ship. Have you ever talked to anybody that's had a ship taken from them by pirates, and whether or not they've ever reflected on whether the soul of the ship was any different when they got it back? I know it's kind of a wacky question, but I was curious.
No, it's actually a really relevant question. I remember being aboard vessels which had been hijacked by Somali pirates, and this was in East Africa. And one of the crew members told me that the ship, it had changed. Now, it was a rust bucket, to be honest, to begin with. But he looked on it. He said that it was just different after the attack. Physically it was different. You could see the bullet holes in it where the pirates
right.
fired off their weapons. But there was a completely bizarre air about it as I walked through it. There was something morose about it, and there was something despairing about it. And I think a lot of that actually came from the reactions of the crew. The captain of one of the vessels seemed to have an air of indifference about it, and he said that he'd been sailing these waters for years, and it was different now. His personality had changed, and he didn't know if he wanted to do it much longer.
That's very interesting. Almost like he picked up the moroseness of the ship after the attack, kind of. Now, when you said you've done some work, interesting, another sort of sidebar is when you were covering the story about the souls of ships, you've been to the place where that you referred to, I think earlier, ship breakers?
Yes. Yes.
What is that like? That's the one part of the, I didn't get the book, so I don't know, but this is the part of the world where they actually go and dismantle these big giant ships?
Yeah, there's a place in northwestern India called Alang, which has to be, it's one of the most fascinating places on the entire planet. There's a beach there, and what happens is they quite literally take a ship on its ready to be scrapped at the end of its, 20 or 30 or 40 year career, and at full speed, at high tide, they ram it up onto the beach. The reason they do it in this place is because it has amongst the highest tides in the entire world.
Huh.
And then teams of men in flip-flops, they climb aboard and they begin to methodically cut it up. The reason they do this is because the steel is very valuable and can be turned into rebars for the construction industry and whatnot.
Right.
And they recycle, they pull out the chairs and the engine parts, and they resell those to people who need spare parts. But it is the graveyard of ships, and when you go there, you will see dozens, well, if you count the carcasses, hundreds of ships lined up there, from naval vessels to cruise liners, all manner of ships. And it is one of the most mysterious places I've ever been, because there's a pall of death which hangs over it, not just from the ships, but because the shipbreakers themselves, they face a high death rate, because it's a fairly dangerous job to do. They can be cut, they could be crushed, they can even be blown up, as I saw while I was there.
What did you mean?
There was a day when I was walking down the shore, and I looked over at what had been a super tanker and was half cut up, and I saw this plume of black smoke just barreling out of the top of it. And I went and asked my translator what was going on. He asked some questions, and it turned out that deep within the bowels of the ship, someone had been cutting into a pipe, and there was a residue of gases within it that were ignited by the blast, or by the torch, and caused the blast, which ended up killing perhaps a half a dozen men. Thing that they never knew, because they try to keep this somewhat secret. And the next day I was told that several bodies washed ashore, which had been wrapped up in plastic. Someone had taken them out trying to dump them at sea.
Oh, gosh. Oh. So they came back with that tide, that very strong tide you were talking about.
Exactly.
Okay. Oh, man. And they break them up and sell the parts. You also, I like the sort of, you were talking about, you kind of been to a similar kind of battlefield where you traveled to Verdun in the famous battlefield of World War One.
Yeah, that was for a documentary film I'd done, looking at the remnants of war, the 20th century's wars, and written by an American journalist named Donovan Webster. His book was called Aftermath, The Remnants of War, same as the film. And there was this unit in the French Interior Ministry whose job is to cull along what used to be the Western Front, you know, from the First World War.
Right.
And I was following a team from Verdun, actually Metz, France, that went up to Verdun. And each day they would go and they would go through the cratered pits, they would go through the forest, they would go through the trenches, and they would pick up unexploded ordnance. Heavy shells, munitions, grenades, gas shells.
To this day.
And in fact, the French government's official figures at that time said they felt that it would take 800 years at this pace to fully clear France of all the unexploded weaponry left over from two world wars. And we always know that governments tend to give you conservative figures.
Right, right. And so what's the difference between when you walk out on a battlefield grave like that, right? Tell me about the sense you get when you walk out there, as opposed to when you were at the big ship graveyard, and any of the other creepy places that you've been around the world.
You know what? The thing that is the most striking I've found is how mundane and peaceful on one level it all is. It can be very businesslike. For instance, in France, these guys would go out and they would find a shell poking up through the ground, which had been heaved up after decades, and they would just start going at it with a pickaxe, which had me somewhat shocked because it seemed so just
right risky.
It was, and it's just like it's like digging something out of your garden,
right?
Only, you know, one wrong tap with the axe or with the pickaxe, and it could go off. Another example, I was in southern Russia, the site of the Battle of Stalingrad, following a guy whose job is to try and exhume and identify bodies which are still buried underneath those fields. And he's hired by German veterans and Austrian veterans organizations. And the first time I went out there, this was the site of the world's worst battle, okay, in history. I mean, millions fought there, millions died. And I'm walking across this field, and I remember turning to him, and I said, I don't get it. I'm expecting to see bombed-out buildings or, you know, craters or pits, and it's a flat field. And he turned to me, and he said, you know, Daniel, he said, you're looking in the wrong place, because I was looking at the horizon line. He said, look down at your feet. And I looked at the field, and it was strewn with little pieces of white rocks everywhere, only they weren't rocks. They were bits of bone. Everywhere in the field, you couldn't take a step without stepping on somebody.
Wow.
And this is what still exists in many places in the world like that. But that was certainly one of the ones telling when you realize that you're walking on
right.
the souls of people.
Yeah, that's like walking. I mean, it's almost like sounds like you're walking on a beach full of seashells, almost.
It's exactly like that. I remember stopping and picking up my foot and realizing it was standing on someone's jawbone.
Right. Oh my God! Was it a recognizable jawbone?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh yeah. And you know, you would see bits of skulls. Certainly, lots of bits and pieces of blown up weaponry.
Right. Right.
He would start digging, probing the ground for what used to be trenches. And at one point, he started digging, and within about an hour, he'd gotten down and he called me over, and he could see the top of a skull. And he unearthed it and picked it up, kind of like, alas, poor York. And then he kept digging, and he found another one. And he took a look at them both, and he started digging around and checking. And he realized one had been a German soldier, or one had been a Russian soldier, Soviet soldier, and the other one had been a Romanian soldier who was fighting with the Germans. And he was able to, by forensically piecing together the trench, realize that the Romanian soldier had probably been entrenched there. The Soviet soldier had probably been a message carrier running through the haze of the battle, had fallen into the trench. And then by showing me the skulls and the cracks on them, each of the guys had beaten each other to death with their entrenching tools, fallen on top of each other, were buried, and were never seen again for 50 years.
Okay. And he was able to tell that just based on what he was able to unearth himself.
That's right, because he could tell by the remnants of their uniforms, the way
Amazing.
The bodies were lying, and the injuries that he found on the actual skulls.
Whether it's piracy or whether it's war or whether it's even just something like the breakup of a ship itself. You sort of like you strike me as sort of part historian, and in a way you're almost you almost have to have sort of a psychic ability of what was there before you got there. I mean, it seems like you're being tested as both an author and a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, well, that's very generous of you, and I think that the thing that I find is that we continually forget our history, and we have a sort of as we get more information through all of these various sources of media, we almost have a kind of a communal ADD going on where we've forgotten the wars that went past. We've forgotten the piracy still goes on. I found it fascinating while working on this film about wars that the generation that came after was the one that was most struck by what happened two generations ago. So when I talked to my parents' generation who'd lived through the Second World War, they weren't fascinated that there was bodies left from wars like the Battle of Stalingrad. They were fascinated by the fact that there was remnants of the First World War. And people who'd lived through the Vietnam War were fascinated that there were still remnants of the Second World War. And
right.
younger people were fascinated that there are the remnants of the Vietnam War.
Right.
So we have this communal amnesia which sets in. And I find that this is what I'm interested in sort of rediscovering and looking at again and finding new ways of bringing this to people to observe and to be entertained by.
Oh, very interesting. Well, you're getting a sense of the work of Daniel Sekulich. The book is True Tales of Modern Day Pirates, Terror on the Seas. But as you've heard, it's just part of what we can talk about when we get to the phones coming up. The souls of ships, these ship graveyards. What to do with a drunken sailor? What can we do with these pirates? And then these amazing battlefield searches that Daniel's been a part of as well. We can take we'll get to the lines here in just a second. But we can take them in a bunch of different directions coming up next. I'll be curious to see where you intersect with this topic next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.